When I came out of the men's room, Freddie motioned for me to come into the kitchen. Among the jostling, disciplined movement of cooks and waiters, Freddie whispered, "There's a man eating outside who asks so many questions about you, Jack. He asks Emilio if you are a bad de Tulia. Emilio no like." "Tell Emilio thanks, Freddie," I said, as I moved out of the kitchen and passed down the entranceway of the trattoria to where Signor Fortunato himself greeted his guests. Looking outside to the enclosed area where tables were set up, I spotted Pericle Storacci looking into the interior of the restaurant. The private investigator was gesturing to someone on the inside. When I returned to the table, Martha had almost finished her fish course. "This is the best fish I've ever eaten anywhere, by far," she said. "Well, that was Shala's favorite. That's why Freddie brought it to you." "Why don't you see anyone from your past, Jack?" she asked. "Because I'm not fond of my past," I said. "It fills me with horror to think about it, ergo I don't." Martha leaned forward. "I see. You've got a love-hate relationship with your family, your friends, even the South." "No," I answered. "I'm unusual in that respect. I have a hate-hate relationship with the South." "It's dangerous to second-guess where you were born," Martha said, and again I caught her looking over my shoulder to the tables outside. "When do you leave Rome, Martha?" "After I see Leah and after you tell me how my parents can get back in your good graces." "Talk to a real estate agent?" I asked. "You could be here for years."
"I've got every right to see Leah. You can't stop me from that."
"Yes, I can. And instead of threatening me or challenging me, I'd take on a conciliatory note. I've arranged my life so I can leave this city tonight and take up residence in another country with relative ease. I live like a man on the run because I fear encounters such as these. I don't need you in my life, and my daughter certainly doesn't need you."
"She's my niece," Martha said.
"She's a lot of people's niece. I'm perfectly consistent. None of my brothers get to see her either. I'm raising Leah so she can be screwed up by only one single relative. That's me. My family's fucked up and your family's fucked up, but I carefully devised a life so that this condition of perpetual damage will not pass to my kid."
"My parents both cry when they talk about Leah. They cry when they realize it's been so many years since they've seen her."
"Good," I said, smiling. "My heart leaps like a doe in the forest when I think of your parents weeping. They can cry all they want.
They say that not seeing Leah's worse than what happened to them during the war."
"Please," I said, putting my face into my hands, tiring of the effort to be pleasant to my wife's only sister. "In your family, if you talk about mowing the lawn, or sewing a button on a shirt, or rotating the wheels on a car, you always end up in Auschwitz or Bergen-Belsen. Talk about going out for a burger and a milkshake or catching a movie on TV, and the next thing you know, bingo, we're on a cattle car moving through Eastern Europe."
"I'm really sorry, Jack, if my parents overemphasized the Holocaust in your presence," Martha shot back angrily. "My parents suffered terribly. They suffered to this very day."
"They didn't suffer half as much as your sister did," I answered, "as much as my wife did."
"How can you make such comparisons?"
"Because Shala's dead and your parents are still alive. The way I keep a scorecard, she wins the grand sweepstakes."
"My father thinks Shala would never have killed herself if she'd married a Jewish man."
"And you still wonder why I won't let my daughter visit your parents?"
"Why do you think Shala killed herself, Jack?" Martha asked.
"I don't know. She started having hallucinations, I know that, but she wouldn't talk about them. She knew they'd go away eventually." "They went away okay, when she went off the bridge."
"Did she ever tell you about the hallucinations she had as a child?"
"No. She didn't say a word about the one she had while she was married. She kept her craziness private."
"I know what those hallucinations were, Jack."
I looked straight into her eyes. "I don't know how to put this more gently, but so what?"
"My mother wants to see you, Jack," Martha said. "That's why I'm here. She thinks she knows why Shyla did it. She wants to tell you herself."
"Ruth," I said, tasting the word. "Ruth. I used to think she was one of the most beautiful women I'd ever seen."
"She's getting older."
"I was in love with your mother when I was growing up."
"But it was your mother who was the town legend."
"One feels guilt about lusting after one's own mother. I felt none lusting after yours."
"My mother knows they were wrong to try to take Leah away from you. They did it out of grief and fury and fear. My mother knows, and my father will never admit it, but he knows it too.
Come to dinner tomorrow night, Martha, I said abruptly. Come and you can meet your niece.
Martha pulled my head to her and kissed me on the cheek.
Leave Pericles behind. You don't need the son of a bitch any longer.
Martha blushed as I turned toward the open patio and waved to the private detective, cowering below an arrangement of flowers.
I've got to do a little preliminary work with Leah about her family tree.
One more thing, Jack.
Quick, before I change my mind.
My mother said to tell you that she killed Shyla, and she's as guilty as if she'd pulled the trigger herself.
Why would she say that? I asked, stunned.
She wants to tell you herself, Jack, face to face, here or back in America.
Let me think about it, I said. I'm going to Venice tomorrow. You're welcome to stay in the apartment and get to know Leah. Please don't tell her about Shyla yet. I still have to work out when is the right time to tell her that her mother killed herself.
When I arrived home, Maria was already asleep, and Leah had fallen asleep in my bed. Her face in repose made me fill up with such amazing tenderness that I wondered if all fathers drank in so hungrily the features of their children.
I had memorized every line and contour of her profile. To me, it was a secret text of nonpareil beauty.
It was beyond my capacity to imagine how to form the words to tell this lovely child that her mother had jumped to her death because she had found life far too agonizing to endure. The secret of her mother's death lay between us, and it was no accident that I had chosen the city of Rome as our place of exile. The pretty walkways over the Tiber were all low, and it was a hard city to kill yourself in by jumping off a bridge.
Chapter 3. Since moving to Italy, I have written 8 articles about the city of Venice for 7 different magazines. Venice is a meal ticket for travel writers, and I love it because it is the only city I have ever come to that is more wonderful than my first preconception of it. It transforms me, uplifts me, as I move through the canals and search for those elusive verbal equivalents that will conjure the tremulous magic of the city to readers who will be invisible to me forever. As I stepped aboard the Taxi Aquae, I inhaled the sea air, a pungent combination of winds from the Adriatic and catastrophic pollution that threatened the very existence of Venice. The varnished mahogany boat began to move along the Grand Canal, and I noted that fever and sewage were still hanging tough in the city. The gondolas we passed moved dreamlike above the water, like black, misshapen swans from bouts of whimsy and nightmare. The sun broke out from behind a cloud bank, and I witnessed again the moment when Venice changed for me the nature of light. Light was beautiful everywhere, but only in Venice did it complete itself fully. In the city where the mirror was invented, each palace along the canal preened like snowflakes in their unholdable images of water. I registered at the Greedy Palace Hotel, one of the finest hotels to grace this capricious, balustrated city. On the Greedy's terrace, I took my position at the best place on the planet to consume a dry martini. Looking out at the river traffic, I lifted my glass and toasted all the heavenly hosts that dwelt beneath the columns of the Maria della Salute across the waterway. I had written a small hymn of praise to the Greedy that had appeared in Esquire magazine, and the manager of the hotel had always treated me like visiting royalty whenever I came to the city. There is something of the whore in every travel writer, and I worried about it everywhere except Venice. The Greedy Palace has that caressed, combed-over, fussed-about quality that is the mark of all great hotels. Its work is done in secret, and its staff, unseen but competent, lives to make you happy. So, at the point where Byzantium and Europe join hands, I sat alone in the city of masks, holding my drink and waiting for the arrival of 2 childhood friends. For the second time in less than 48 hours, I would come face to face with my past. But Venice was enough of an imaginary retreat from the world to make me ready for almost anything. As I sat studying the shapes of flamboyant palaces, the city looked as though a troop of organ grinders and manic chess players had designed it for the praise of glassblowers. Its celebration of pure whimsy made it a playground and a conundrum, a place where decadence had both a field day and a day off.
It always made me wish I was a flashier, less serious man.
Buongiorno, the concierge of the hotel said, handing me a note. Come sta?
Molto bene, Arturo, I answered. Have Signor Hess and Signora Ansley checked into the hotel?
They arrived this morning separately, Arturo said. Signora Hess left this note for you. He is the famous producer from Hollywood, no?
Was it hard to tell? I asked.
Mr. Hess is larger than life.
Been that way since he was a kid, I said.
The woman is bellissima, Arturo said.
She was born that way, I said. I was an eyewitness.
I opened Mike's note to me and recognized his almost illegible handwriting, which reminded me of untied shoes.
Hey, dear fuck, he began sweetly. We'll meet for drinks on the terrace at 6. Nice joint. Don't beat off on the sheets. Chow and all that shit, Mike.
High school is a kind of starting gate, I thought, as I waited for my friend's arrival above the traffic of the Grand Canal. I had always considered the friends of my childhood special, but it had surprised me to see one of them become world-famous by the time he was 30. In the darkness of the Breeze Theater, Mike Hess had fallen in love with movies and the world surrounding them. He would watch a movie with the same fastidious passion that an art historian brought to the study of a Titian. His powers of attention and memorization were extraordinary, and he could name every actor who appeared in All About Eve, as well as the fictional characters they portrayed. Snow White was the first movie he ever saw, and he could take you on a journey from the opening credits to Snow White riding off into the rosy future with her prince, barely missing a single detail. Even his personality had been flamboyant and pixelated, so Mike always seemed destined to make movies. But I was even more curious to see Ladere Ansley. Mike and I stayed close for a while after college, but I had rarely seen Ladere since our senior year at the University of South Carolina. Though we had dated off and on throughout high school, we'd never seemed to know each other very well. Her beauty had made her unapproachable, apart. She was one of those girls who pass through your life leaving secret wreckage, but no visible wake. You remember her, but for all the wrong reasons. She had written me my first love poem, which she presented to me on my birthday, but she wrote it in code and never felt confident enough to provide me with its key. In high school, for my entire junior year, I walked around school carrying a page of handwritten gibberish, an untranslatable love note I could neither decipher nor enjoy. I thought of that poem now in Venice, where all images are forgeries stolen from water. A hand touched my shoulder, and I knew that touch.
"Hello, stranger," Ladere Ansley said. "Buy me this hotel, and I might blow you a kiss when I go off to bed."
"Hey, Ladere," I said, rising. "I knew you were born to have this place."
"Heaven couldn't be this lovely," Ladere said. We embraced. "How are you, Jack? Everybody's worried about you."
"I'm doing fine," I said. "Leaving South Carolina in the dust has had its rewards."
"Well, I've been in New York for the past 5 years," she said. "You don't need to sell me on why you left."
"Well, I didn't intend to," I said.
"How are your kids?"
"They're fine, I guess," she said, and I knew I had struck a sore point.
"Both of them live with their father. Capers has convinced them that he needs them when he runs for governor."
"If Capers becomes governor, it means democracy doesn't work."
She laughed and said, "He said to say hello to you. He still thinks very highly of you."
"Since we're passing messages, please tell Capers that I often think of him, too. Any time I ponder viruses or the spores of poisoned mushrooms, I think of him. When my thoughts turn to hemorrhoids or diarrhea cultures..."
"I get the point," she said.
"I knew you would," I said. "You were always a quick study."
"Au contraire," Ladere said. "I was the slowest of all. Remember, I married the charming son of a bitch."
"A slight misdirection, a wrong turn in the road," I said.
"More like modern warfare," she said. "First I blew up the city, tortured all my friends, set the fields afire, salted the earth, then blew up all the bridges that might have gotten me back where I started."
"Didn't work out, huh?" I said, enjoying her.
"You could always read between the lines," she said.
"Uh-oh," I said, looking toward the hotel lobby. "Something oddball this way comes."
Mike Hess moved toward us with his rapid, confident stride. His energy level was high, and he always seemed agitated, like a Pepsi bottle shaken before it was opened. Every eye on the terrace locked onto him as Mike approached our table. His grooming was immaculate, his manner efficient and no-nonsense. Mike grabbed me in a bear hug the moment I stood up and kissed me on both cheeks, more Hollywood than Italy. He kissed Ladair on the lips.
"Hollywood broad still can't hold a candle to you, Ladair. I still get a hard-on when I think of you in your cheerleader uniform."
"You always know a way to a girl's heart, Mike," said Ladair as we all sat.
"I didn't recognize you without your gold chains," I said to Mike.
"Biggest mistake I ever made," Mike said, laughing at himself. "Wearing those goddamn chains to our 10th reunion. But hell, everyone wanted to see me play movie producer. My love of my classmates won that day. I gave the public what it wanted. Open silk shirt, chains glittering in the old chest hair. Who did I take to that?"
"Tiffany Blake," Ladair said. "She was your wife."
"Great woman," Mike said. "Had to dropkick her right out of my life after my son Creighton was born. She had a bad habit of fucking people not married to her."
"You've had that reputation yourself," Ladair observed.
"Hey, careful," Mike said, gesturing toward me. "The last time I saw Jack here, he referred to me as a shallow fuck."
"How rude and ungallant of me," I said, smiling, then added, "Michael, you shallow fuck."
Mike stood up dramatically and pretended he had been shot in the stomach. He staggered backward, wheeled around, and slumped over the railing above the Grand Canal, feigning death. His performance was real enough to attract the attention of two puzzled waiters, who inquired after Mike's health.
"Get up, Mike," said Ladair. "Try to pretend you know how to act in a good hotel."
"It's a gunshot, amigos. No use to call the medicos," Mike said. "Tell Mama I died while saying Kaddish for Papa."
Mike snapped suddenly to attention and came back to his seat. He bowed to an elderly Italian woman, who certainly had not enjoyed his performance, and gave him a look of frosty annoyance. Her contempt seemed to bother Mike.
"There in a nutshell. See that face?" Mike said. "That's why foreign movies suck. There's no life force, no brio here."
"No brio?" I said. "In Italy?"
"No life force," said Ladair. "Anna Magnani, Sophia Loren, these people invented life force."
"Been to a foreign movie lately?" Mike said, ignoring her. "All they do is go in and out of doors for 2 endless hours. No one dies, no one gets his ass shot off, no one fucks or laughs. They just go in and out of doors or eat endless dinners. In one door and out the other. Oh, here comes the soup course. They cut their chicken up for a half hour of screen time. That woman's face, that's all you need to know about why European movies stink."
Ladair nodded her head and said, "She criticized your acting. She didn't fall for your juvenile death scene from High Noon."
"Hey," Mike said, "I did the same routine not long ago in the Polo Lounge, same one, in front of my peers in the industry, and I got a standing ovation from some of the coldest-hearted bastards that ever lived. I speak gospel here."
"You think what works at the Polo Lounge," I said, "will work at the Greedy Palace?"
"Hey, I grew up with you in South Carolina," Mike said, taking my wrist. "There's a palmetto on my birth certificate."
"Admit it, Mike," I said. "Your native land's now Rodeo Drive. That's the real you. Everything else in your life's just affectation."
"Don't you just love it?" Mike said, laughing appreciatively. "I could buy and sell this nobody 50 times and still get Grandpa a new set of horseshoes, and this guy still gives me shit. You gotta love this guy."
A new waiter came over, shook hands with me, and we exchanged pleasantries in Italian. Then, in English, I ordered a dry Tanqueray martini, straight up with a twist. Mike wrinkled his nose.
"Martini? That's like a June Allison movie. I'm in danger of dying of a Perrier and lime overdose. Only put stuff in the engine that's unleaded. Gotta get you two out to L.A. You'd be papaya-breathed in a month."
"I'll translate the Italian," I said to Ladair, "if you explain what Mike's talking about."
"He doesn't drink anymore," she said.
"I've got a personal trainer the whole 9 yards," Mike said. "The cat used to be a cornerback for the Rams, and if you don't think he takes my ass to the well..."
"Read any of Tolstoy lately, Mike?"
I asked, as the waiter brought him his drink.
"I like it. I really like it. People shaking their Tinkerbell shoes when I walk into an L.A. meeting, and Jack sits here shoveling shit down my throat. Hell, man, I read screenplays nonstop from A.M. to P.M.
Non-fucking-stop. If they don't get my attention by the first or second page, the script is airborne. Flying the friendly skies out the fucking window. Time's a precious metal to me, man.
Translation, please? I asked, looking at Ladere.
He reads a lot of movie scripts. Doesn't like a lot of them. Busy man, Ladere said.
Here's to friendship. I lifted my glass to both of them. The three of us touched glasses.
There's something about the friends you made as a kid that can never be duplicated, Mike said, and there was a slight catch in his voice.
Speak for yourself, Ladere answered. I've made a lot of friends I like better since then.
Get sentimental and Ladere sends a spear through your heart. She hasn't changed much, has she, Jack?
I'm the one who can tell you, Mike. You don't have to ask Jack. Always go to the source, Ladere said before I could answer.
Why'd you want to meet in Venice? I asked Mike when I saw that Ladere had heard him. You said you had a project.
Project? I got an idea so fucking ballistic that I could fully arm a nuclear submarine.
He means he's got a good idea, Ladere explained.
I won't allow you to dampen my natural enthusiasm, Ladere, so you might as well quit trying. I speak the lingo of my community, just like Jack down here. You want octopus in this burg, you gotta go with the word calamari.
What's the project, Mike? I asked again.
Hey, not so fast. This meeting isn't being timed. Let's just sit here and sop up each other's eyes, as the poet said.
How's Leah, Jack? Ladere asked.
Yeah, the mystery kid, the one you Lindberghed out of South Carolina.
I didn't kidnap her, Mike. She was my kid, and I decided we'd move to Italy.
Hey, I'm sensitive to your sensitivities. That's just the talk around the old gang.
The old gang, I said softly. I want to run for cover every time I think about the old gang.
We had some ups and downs, but we had some great times, too.
Jack's thinking of the casualties, Ladere said.
Casualties, I like it. Makes great box office.
Beautifully phrased, Ladere said. You add something exotic to Venice, you really do.
Ladere, I hope this doesn't set our relationship back when I say, from the bottom of my heart, please go fuck yourself. Now maybe you understand why I didn't get around to reading your screenplay.
You read it, she said coolly, because you were in it.
Mike said, you weren't exactly fair. It hurt me.
Music to my ears, she said, motioning to the waiter for another drink.
This is making me nervous, I interrupted, and it's making me sorry I agreed to come up here for this meeting. I don't enjoy it when people start fighting old wars that they can't win, especially when I should be getting VA benefits from fighting in the same wars.
Relax, Jack, Mike said, holding his hands up in a gesture of surrender. I was warned that you might cut and run any time, but you need to hear me out. I've thought about doing this for a long time, worked it out in my head, tried to position myself in the industry so when the time was ripe, I'd be ready to break the melons and spit out the seeds. Everything's in place. I've got a film that's going to be released in the fall that I'm trying to get into the Venice Film Festival. It'll make me some dough, as in dough a deer, a female deer. And it's a little on the artsy-fartsy side, too. Quit nailing my ass in your work, pumpkin, and maybe I can produce one of your screenplays on the silver screen one day, he said, looking at Ladere suddenly.
Her southern heart went pitter-patter at the approach of her Beauregard, Ladere said, with chill nonchalance, as she studied the silhouette of the church across the canal.
I don't care if you make one of my films or not, Mike. That's why you love me.
I want you two to write a miniseries about the South for me, based on our town and our families, from the beginning, when my grandfather arrived in Waterford, to the present time.
Miniseries, I said unpleasantly. What an ugly phrase.
Think of it as many dollars. It'll eradicate any aesthetic problem you might have about writing for television.
Ladere said, My problem is working with you, Mike. That's what I told you when you first mentioned this to me, and it's the same problem I've got now.
You didn't have a problem accepting a free ticket to Venice, did you?
None whatsoever, Ladere said. I wanted to see Jack again and have him take me to all the secret places of Venice.
Can you drink the water in this burg, Jack? Mike asked, lowering his voice.
I mean, from the tap, or should I brush my teeth with Perrier? I went to Mexico last year and thought Montezuma had crawled up my ass to take a nap.
It's Venice, not Tijuana. Water's fine.
Mike seemed happy that one more troublesome aspect of travel had evaporated with my assurance.
What do you think about my concept for the Southern series? Fire away.
Count me out, Ladere said. Wait a minute, Sweet Gums. My key has left out the most important part.
He took a pen and wrote a number down on a piece of paper and held it up for both Ladere and me to see. A gondolier moved below them, going home for the day, navigating his beautiful boat for himself, not for tourists.
That's how much money I plan to spend for riders on this series. Let's face it, that's more money than Jack's ever made flipping burgers, and I include paperback and intergalactic sales. Jack sure as hell doesn't make that kind of bread writing about lamb kidneys and pizza bianca.
Thanks for holding my profession in such high regard, Mike, I said irritably.
Ladere studied the figure that Mike had written on the piece of paper, then said, So this is why everyone in California is so shallow.
Maybe so, Mike said, his voice rising slightly to meet the challenge of her irony, but it sure sharpens your aptitude for higher mathematics.
I shook my head as I watched the boat traffic move by them. I came to Italy to get away from all that.
Hey, I'm not asking you to write the personal stuff. Nothing about you going to the deep freeze. Nothing about Shiloh and the bridge shit. I'm talking about the general history, the big picture. My grandparents, yours, Jack. Capers' granddad was one of the biggest politicians of his time. I mean, there's a story there. We come from shit, but our families have this burning desire to make it better for their children and grandchildren. And son of a bitch, they pull it off. Look, it's got everything. 2 world wars, the civil rights movement, the 60s, Vietnam, right up to now.
How long is this miniseries supposed to be? Ladere asked.
Hey, a lot of telescoping, a lot of voiceover. We hit the high points and cover the century. I think it's a hell of an exciting idea, and if you two don't, a lot of writers want to be part of this project.
Hire them, I suggested.
None of them were there, Mike said, and for the first time I saw remnants of the old Michael, the boy I grew up with and loved. Not like we were. They didn't live through what we lived through. I keep waiting for Ladere to write about what we saw in South Carolina as kids, but everything she writes takes place in a tanning salon for feminists in Manhattan.
Let's not fight, I said.
Mike answered, Fight? Shit, man, in South Carolina we don't even know how to fight. In L.A., you know you've been in a good fight when your dick falls into the toilet when you take a morning piss.
I don't want to work with you, Mike, I said. I came here because I was curious and wanted to see what it would be like for all of us to be together again. I get less nostalgic about the past than you do, but I'm nostalgic about us and our innocence and what we went through together and how it might have turned out if we'd been luckier.
Then write it like you wish it had turned out, Mike said, leaning toward me. You want to write it nicer? Great, make it nice. It'll be paradise to work with me. I'm a sweetheart to work with. Here's some numbers I want you to call. Collect. They'll know you'll be my Bellinim.
Numbers? I asked.
People that have worked with me, he said. They'll back me up.
Let me give Jack some other numbers, Mike, Ladere said. The people who spit over their left shoulders when your name's mentioned.
You make enemies in my business, Mike said. That's the nature of the beast.
Then give Jack the numbers of people who'd set you on fire just to see if their lighter worked. Half that town thinks you've always been a son of a bitch.
But they didn't know me as a boy, Mike said. Not like you guys did. I wasn't this way when I was growing up.
I'm sorry, Mike, Ladere said. I didn't mean for it to sound like that.
No problem, Ladere. I know where it's coming from. I don't know what happened to me any more than you do. That's why I want you and Jack to do this project. I'd like you to help me find out. I know I'm alive. I just don't know how to feel it anymore. Ciao, amigos. I got a meeting. You too, powwow.
As we made our way toward the elevators, Ladere asked,
You're not going to take Mike's offer, are you, Jack?
No. The thing I love about the past most is not thinking about it.
Chapter 4 The next afternoon I led Ladere through different parts of the city and watched her watch Italian women, exquisitely turned out, moving along the narrow alleys toward their homes. A woman came out of a small boutique and walked toward us, making me step behind Ladere on the narrow walkway, just off the Calle del Traghetto. Ladere stopped and stared at the woman, meeting her eyes, taking in what she was wearing, the high carriage of her walk, the beautiful legs, the thoughtless elegance, everything. She inhaled her scent.
You'll get used to that, I said.
I doubt it, Ladere answered. She is beautiful.
There's something magic about Italian women.
She looked like she was spun from pure gold. If I were you, I'd follow that woman to the end of the line and never lose sight of her.
Ladere continued. I laughed and again moved beside her as we crossed through the Campo di Santa Margherita, where a group of small boys were playing soccer beneath the disapproving gaze of an elderly Monsignor. An old woman watered a window box full of geraniums, and an artist stood at the entrance of the Campo, painting the whole scene in the late afternoon light. I was deeply aware that I was walking beside one of the lives I had refused to live. Once our pasts were entangled in such complex ways that it seemed we were meant for each other if we allowed ourselves to surrender to the simplest lures of inertia. The friends of our childhood paired us off, almost by fiat. Our temperaments seemed tranquil and complementary from first grade on. Both of us, from the beginning, looked as though we belonged on the same side of the chessboard. It was my mother who first gave me the signifying key that Ladere was bashful to the point of torment. My mother taught me that beauty was often a fine, untouchable gift, but it almost always belonged to the world more than the girl. She spotted the burden and responsibility of Ladere's unasked-for beauty and recognized that the child was lonely. Wordlessly, Ladere and I effected a merger of our solitudes, giving ourselves up to the main current in our lives. As we walked beside each other in Venice, both of us felt the force of a story untold and a journey not taken. It moved as a third person between us. I knew that Ladere was hard on herself for the choices she had made, but she had grown up in that pampered, baby-talking way that the South has of making its girls follow the paths of least resistance. Just when she thought she was learning to think for herself and make up her own mind, she found herself in perfect lockstep with her parents' worst instincts. Though she knew she had long been immune to her parents' gift-wrapped poison, she found it began to kill her only when she chose a husband. By a series of flawless stratagems and carefully thought-out choices, she managed to marry the one person who thought she was both worthless and contemptible. She married a man who was happy to ratify her most negative assumptions and sentiments about herself, and who eventually came to hate everything about her. When I was a young man, I would have thought this kind of marriage rare. Now, I believe it is as common as grass. I have seen enough loveless marriages to fill up most of the empty spaces in the desert regions of the American West. American mothers teach their sons how to break a girl's spirit without even knowing they are imparting such dangerous knowledge. As boys, we learn to betray our future wives by mastering the subtle ways our mothers can be broken by our petulance and disapproval. My own mother provided me with all the weaponry I will ever need to ruin the life of any woman foolish enough to love me. Ladere hooked her arm through mine, and for a moment we both were happy. Ladere had married one of those American men who used language and sex without regard to consequence or decency. Her love for him had damaged her confidence in her love for herself. For 5 years, she had tried to recover a sense of equilibrium after her husband left her for a 20-year-old woman who was physically a younger, flashier edition of Ladere herself. She told me she had made up a list of the men in her life whom she would trust to fall in love with if she ever felt strong enough to sally forth in those sharply contested fields again. I had been on that list until the day I remembered that Shiloh had committed suicide. When she remembered that, she had crossed me carefully off the list and put in phone calls to the other 3 men who survived the cut. Like the other women who knew me, Ladere thought I bore much of the responsibility for Shiloh's death, even though she knew little or nothing about our life together. From a bridge overlooking one of the minor canals, I pointed at 2 elderly craftsmen putting the finishing touches on a gondola. They were employed by the gondola factory that still made the boats by hand. "I've got a friend named Gino," I said, taking Ladere's arm. "His station's not far from here."
"You figured out a nice way to make a living, Jack. I knew you could roast oysters and cook a pig, but I never dreamed you'd write cookbooks. And it never occurred to me you'd spend your life writing about beautiful cities and great places to eat."
"No one thought you'd write for the movies, either."
"I think I did," she said, turning toward me. "But I also think you just might have run away."
"I might have, Ladere, but it's my call, and I get to do what I want to do. It's one of the few benefits of growing up."
"I sometimes tell friends in New York about what it was like growing up in Waterford, Jack. I tell about the crowd we ran around with, all of us, and they can't believe the stories. They say I make it sound like I grew up surrounded by gods and goddesses. They tell me I'm exaggerating. They never believe it. I tell them about Mike first, because they've all heard of him. Then about you and your family, Shiloh and her family, Capers and Jordan, Max the Great Jew, Mother. I can never tone the stories down to make them believable. Was there one of us who didn't seem smart to you even then? Yeah, I didn't seem so smart to me, even then. Not smart enough to get out of the way.
Out of the way of what?
I didn't know that everything you do is dangerous, everything. The smallest, most inconsequential act can be the thing that brings you crashing to earth.
Were there any signs or omens, tea leaves we could have read if we'd been alert?
You're not supposed to see the signs. They're invisible and odorless and don't leave tracks. You don't even feel them till you find yourself on your knees weeping over their unbearable weight, I said. I maneuvered her toward an alley that led past a trattoria and a dry cleaner's with misted windows. The smell of garlic and hanging pork poured out of the trattoria. I've never eaten in that trattoria. It must be new.
How wonderful, Ladere said. Is that how we turn the subject away from the horror of it all?
I've trained myself not to think about South Carolina much, Ladere, especially those parts that only cause pain, like Shiloh. I hope you understand. If you don't, pardon me, but I don't need to ask your permission about what I get to think about. Nor do you have to ask my permission to write about anything you goddamn feel like. And never, not once, Ladere, have you written a word about what happened to us, gods and goddesses of your childhood.
Why, Jack, it's been years since I've heard the president of my senior class give a speech, she teased, smiling.
You shitbird, you trapped me.
It's funny, Jack. South Carolina's always been the forbidden subject to me. I've never written a word about it, alluded to it in the slightest way, and never thought I would until Mike took me to lunch in New York last month. My parents live in absolute terror that I'll reveal secrets of the manor that'll bring shame and disaster to the family name.
Your family doesn't have secrets, Ladere, I said. It's just got bones.
Does it surprise you that Capers is running for governor?
Capers is running for governor. I laughed out loud. It was inevitable. Do you remember how he used to talk about running for governor when we were in the first and second grade? Can you believe someone can be that ambitious and single-minded when they're only 7 years old?
Of course I can believe it. If you remember, Jack, I married him and mothered two of his children, she said, and a trace of bitterness put a ragged edge on her voice.
You know what I think about your ex-husband, I said. Let's let that subject pass.
But you don't know what I think about him, she said, at least not currently. Do you believe he's running as the Republican candidate?
A Republican? I said, genuinely surprised. I'd rather have a sex change operation than vote Republican in South Carolina. Even Capers should be ashamed of his ass. No, not Capers. Shame has no part to play in his button-down theater of the absurd.
My son and daughter are his greatest fans.
She paused and seemed to hold her breath.
They don't like me as much as they like their father. He's a bastard, but charming. You could put Capers next to a chameleon, and Capers would be the one to change colors.
I can't even think about any of these people without being overwhelmed by a sense of guilt. I feel guilty that I hate Capers, even though I know I've got perfectly legitimate reasons for hating his ass.
I don't feel a bit guilty for hating him, she said.
We stopped for a moment to watch a brindled cat sleeping in a window.
You once tried to explain the relationship of Catholicism and guilt, and I didn't understand a word of it. Your being a Catholic was just one more odd thing about the McCall family.
Well, guilt's my mainstream, I explained, the central theme of my life. The church laid a foundation of pure guilt inside me. They raised a temple in the soft center of a child. Floors were paved with guilt. Statues of saints were carved out of great blocks of it.
You're an adult now, Jack. Get on with it. Surely you figured out how silly and stupid this all is.
No one agrees with you more. But you were raised an Anglican, and Anglicans only feel guilty if they forget to feed their polo ponies or cover their stock margins.
That's not what I'm talking about. You've always acted like guilt was something real, something you could hold in your hands. You need to let go of it, Jack.
We walked deeper into Venice in silence. As I caught glimpses of Ladere's face, I found her beauty still diffident and withheld. She was so pretty that her comeliness seemed more of a mission than a gift.
Ladere had always proved reluctant to accept the responsibilities that beauty asks of women. I can still remember watching Ladere water skiing in the Waterford River after her mother had bought her a yellow bikini in Charleston. She had always been a show-off on skis, being pulled by a fast boat, doing fancy tricks on her slalom. But on that day, the men of the town lined the banks like crows on a wire to admire the soft, newly sculpted curves that had happened so recently on her thin, girlish body. Her ripening was so sudden and lush that it became a topic of conversation in the pool halls and along the bar stools in town. She had found being pretty trying enough. Ladere found being sexy unbearable. Since nothing discomforted her more than the unwanted attention of men, Ladere packed the yellow bikini in the same box that held the summer dresses of her childhood days. I studied Ladere's face, her loveliness, her fine features. "You promised me a gondola ride," Ladere said, changing the subject as we began walking back toward the Grand Canal. "We're near Gino's spot, the handsomest of the gondoliers." "Does he prey on pretty American girls?" "You're doomed, kid," I said, winking at her. As we walked through streets that seemed too narrow for breathing, we smelled onions frying in olive oil and heard the sound of voices carrying, airborne and mysterious, along the canals. We passed houses where canaries sang to each other from brightly lit windows and inhaled the aroma of fried liver and heard the slapping of water against the dark, carved hulls of the gondolas and the scream of male cats. Ladere paused at a mask shop where grotesque, quasi-human faces stared back at us in all the mute terror of their eyelessness. We continued on, listening to the church bells and squabbles among children, pigeons calling to each other from rooftops, and the sound of our own footsteps along the canal. Gino was waiting at his post near the Academia and smiled when he saw us. He bowed deeply when I introduced him to Ladere. Gino was short and blonde and had a gondolier's deeply sculpted body. I noticed that Gino took Ladere in all at once in a long, appreciative gaze. The gondola rode high in the Grand Canal, swan-necked and proud as a horse, as Ladere sat by me with her arm through mine. Gino moved with strong, perfect motions behind us, a sweet action of wrists and forearms. Ladere let her hand drift down the side of the gondola as a wave from a vaporetto washed over it, while Gino maneuvered the craft expertly through the choppy waters of the canal. Ladere said, "This city does something to reality. I've felt like a contessa since I arrived. Floating through here, I feel like I'm made of silk."
"You'll wish you were made of money before you leave," I promised. "It's cheaper to live in heaven."
"You think heaven's prettier than Venice?" she asked, looking around us.
"Too much to ask," I said.
I remembered my stay in Venice during Carnevale, after Shyla died, when I had been covering the revelry of Venetians before the long fastings and privations of Lent. During the wildest part of that first night, I had marveled at these people who were celebrating the pleasures of the flesh with such open-ended immoderation, could turn so quickly to the darker joys of self-denial. It had snowed that February, deep drifting snow born in the high passes of the Alps, and I had felt like a child throwing snowballs with other tourists in St. Mark's Square. I had forgotten that Southerners are always made happy by the sight of snow. It always surprises us. I bought a mask and a costume to blend in with the Venetians in their suddenly disguised city. Running through the streets, following various bands of revelers, I joined parties I was not invited to, as I let the crowd steer me past the entryways of snow-dusted, candle-lit palazzos. In silence and in costume, I drifted through that white, starry world, as strange as those attendant angels who filled up the wall space in unpraised chapels. By not speaking, I lost myself in the lawlessness of Carnevale, and felt the power of masks to disfigure the shape of my own superego for the lurid rites of celebration. I thought that Shyla's leap had unmasked me in some profound, unknowable way. But on that night, the mask returned me to myself as I rushed through the city with a sense of rising joy. In the cold of Venice, I felt time burn off me as I danced with anonymous women and drank wine that flowed easily in this greenhouse of pleasure, where I felt myself recovering something lost in a playing field of masks. I watched a young priest scurry into a safe passageway as though the air itself was contaminated. He looked around once, taking it all in, and we bowed to each other before he disappeared. He was right to flee this unloosened night, religious only at the fringes, and he crossed himself as he entered his hermitage. The priest had escaped the one licensed whirl that centered around lust's shining eloquence. Then I ran down slippery, half-lit streets, going deeper and deeper into the unknown Venice, wishing I could weep at last for poor lost Shyla. I thought the tears would come easily behind a mask, but I was wrong again. After her death, I had no time to cry for Shyla, and I covered my grief with the excuse that Leah needed my strength far more than any breakdown. So I made an appointment for myself at Carnevale, and as I wandered farther into Venice, covered with chasubles of snow, I wanted to make time for all the tears I carried in me. None came, not a one, because the spirit of the city lifted me along with the fog that rose up along the waterways as ice began to erase the current in the smaller canals. Another party of 10 to 20 people sped past on a narrow and treacherous path, and a woman reached out and grabbed my hand. I followed her as fireworks exploded high above the Grand Canal, and a siren went off deep in the unsleeping city. She led me upstairs to an apartment where we slow danced to a Frank Sinatra album of love songs at a party so crowded that we simply swayed against the other bodies in the smoke-filled room. The woman was masked, but my imagination filled in every detail of her features. In their masks, all the women turned into famous beauties, and all the men dazzled with their handsomeness, and the woman I danced with began to ask me questions in Italian. I could not speak a word of Italian without letting the entire country in on the fact that I was an American. "Ah," the woman said in her rich, musical voice, "I was hoping you were Chinese." "Then I am Chinese," I said in Italian. "I am a contessa," she said proudly. "I can trace my family's origins all the way back to the 12th Doge." "This is true?" I asked. "On this night everything is true," she said. "All women are contessas at Carnevale." My Italian had come to its farthest border, and I asked in English, "Does the mask make it easy to lie?"
"The mask makes it necessary to lie."
"Then you are not a contessa," I said.
"I am a contessa on the same night every year, and I expect the whole world to pay me the homage I am due."
I stepped back and bowed deeply. "My adored contessa."
"My servant," she said, curtsied, then disappeared into the crowd.
Back outside, I walked westward through the deepening snow, and my feet began to freeze in my silly costume shoes. Pretty women hidden behind lacquered masks laughed and ran away at my approach. The Venetian alleyways, claustrophobic and narrow, exaggerated my height, and my shadow thrown across courtyards seemed vast and ecclesiastical. Near the Baroque facade of the Church of the Gesuiti, a woman appeared in the snow alone. She giggled when she saw me, half frozen and ridiculous in my cheap costume, but she did not run away. We both laughed when we realized we were the only two people out in this obscure part of the city. The masked woman, dressed virginally in white, took my hand as I tried to speak, but she put a silencing finger to my lips. Returning her touch, I traced her full bottom lip with my finger until she bit it roughly. She then took my hand and hurried me through passages and beneath arches until we came to a part of the city where I had never walked. When we entered an alleyway too narrow for two people to walk side by side, she turned and wrapped a scarf around my eyes, laughing as she made sure the blindfold covered my mask completely. Convinced I could see nothing, she led me down the alley, leading me like an aerialist beckoning on the high wire. Far off in the city, I could hear the voices of the celebrants sounding distant and abstracted. I followed her blindly and trusted her as she led me through a doorway and up four flights of narrow stairs. We entered a room, and she removed the scarf from my eyes. The room was so dark that I could see nothing clearly in the perfect warm darkness, and heard only the slapping of water against the sides of unseen boats tied up outside. Then I felt her naked against me, and her mouth found my mouth, and her tongue hunted for my tongue, and drove it back deep against my throat. Her mouth tasted like wine and seawater, like womanhood distilled. I licked her throat and breasts as she moved me toward a bed, laid me down on freshly laundered cotton sheets, then unbuttoned each button of my costume. She licked my chest in her purring descent down my body. When her mouth reached my penis, she took it down her throat and back up in a swift, purling motion, like a fire-eater, and pushed the limits of both burlesque and desire. The scrimmage of her tongue took me to the high ledges of orgasm. Then she released me suddenly and rolled me over her. We kissed again, and I tasted myself, and the taste of her mouth was a different flavor as I entered her. I knew in that moment that she would choose to remain anonymous. There would be no ceremony of unmasking. As I moved inside her and rode her with abandon, I surrendered myself to the night, a night when sex bloomed like a wildflower in a secret alcove of the imagination, when lust roared and bawled and allowed itself to be primal, animal, unnameable, as it was in the caves and forests and the light of fires, when fire was not yet a word and the body still was a being without a name. Now, as the gondola moved through the lights playing in the Grand Canal, I tried to remember her long, unseen limbs, to conjure her every movement in the deciduous empire of touch, every pressure of her breasts and response of her legs and heels, all shivers and sighs in the bright resume of her passion. She had spoken no words to me, nor I to her, and the mere fact of our wordlessness had excited me further. When I came, my scream met her scream, and our tongues bruised against the sound. Then, exhausted and sweating, we fell off each other, and again we heard the splash of water, of boats drumming against their moorings and straining against ropes and tides, accompanied by our own heavy panting as our lovemaking cooled slowly. Her hair fell against my chest as we lay together in the blackened room. Ladere touched me on the cheek, her fingers wet from letting them drift in the currents.
"A penny for your thoughts."
"I was thinking about the place of existentialism in modern literature," I said. "Liar," she said, flicking her fingers and spraying me playfully with canal water.
Whatever it was, I could tell it was nice.
"Life-changing," I said.
"They built this city so you'd never want to leave it, didn't they, Jack?"
Ladere said. "No," I said. "I think they are nicer than that. They built it so you'd always have something to dream about."
"It breaks my heart how pretty it all is," she said.
"Venice travels well," I said. "She won't leave you." In the room I'd heard footsteps moving through the snow, light and muffled. The woman left the bed quickly, but again she put a finger to my lips. She returned with my costume, my soaked shoes, which she must have warmed on some kind of heater. When I dressed, she led me to the doorway and ran my hands over her unseen face like a blind man reading his favorite poem in Braille. Then she put on her mask, then mine, and once more blindfolded me with a scarf and led me down the stairway and into the snow. I followed her through the bitterly cold night toward the noise and the crowds and the beginning of Lent. I attempted to talk to her in my Berlitz Italian, begged her for her name, explained that I wanted to see her again, to take her to dinner. She laughed when I spoke, and her laughter revealed that she knew her mystery and her silence were the essential erotica of our time together. We crossed a bridge, and her hand left mine suddenly as I was asking her if Venice was her hometown. I tried to call out to her, but realized there was no name to call. Removing the scarf from around my mask, I found myself disoriented at an intersection of four Venetian alleys. I listened for sounds of running or flight, but her escape was silent. I spun in a circle, but only saw other masked figures like myself coming over bridges, some carrying bottles of wine, some candles or flashlights. The flashlights crisscrossed through the snowy air. Voices rose everywhere, but it was her silence I longed for. I tried to retrace my steps, but this was Venice, and the woman had given me all the time she was willing to give. Before I left the city, I wandered over it, especially in that obscure neighborhood by the Gesuiti, where I guessed my secret lover had taken me. I wanted to thank and praise her and cry her name aloud. I had not made love to a woman since Shiloh's death. My body had been shut down until that night of snow in Venice and the woman of the mask, the woman who understood the mystery of remaining unnamed, the woman who did not utter a single word. Much later, I suspected that the woman might have been Shiloh herself, telling me it was time to get on with my life and to forget about her. Dressing up and playing make-believe were two of the things that Shiloh loved best. When Ladere and I arrived at the greedy palace, I paid Gino with a 50,000 lira note. Gino kissed Ladere's hand and offered to take her on a tour of the smaller canals for free the next day. Then we went up to dress for dinner. Mike was already seated when we walked into the Taverna La Fenice later that evening. "Have a seat. You look beautiful, Ladere. You could get arrested in that dress," Mike said. "Nice place here, Jack. No pizza joint for the Three Musketeers, huh?"
"It's an old favorite of mine," I said. "I thought you two would like it."
When the waiter came to take our order, I was explaining the menu. "The pastas are terrific here. The bigoli con granziola is made with a crab sauce. They don't taste much like our blue crabs, but they taste great anyway. The veal dishes are all good. And if you like liver, Venice is the place." "Just tell the guy I'll have a hamburger and a green salad with Roquefort cheese dressing," Mike said. "They don't have hamburgers here, and they don't have Roquefort cheese dressing in Italy."
"No hamburgers? It's a restaurant, isn't it? The fucking Four Seasons in New York serves hamburgers."
"I'd trust Jack on this one," Ladere said. "He covers this territory."
"I don't believe the Roquefort cheese dressing either," Mike added. "Where do they make Roquefort cheese? Answer me that one."
"In France," Ladere said.
"Right, France. Next fucking country, yes? Bet it's not 300 miles from here. I don't eat salad without Roquefort."
"You will tonight," I said.
"Italy's still the third world, man. You think they'd get the picture and sign up for the 20th century. Get me some veggies and some of that thin veal. What's that real skinny veal called? Starts with an S."
"Scallopini."
"You order for me, Jack," Ladere said.
I smiled and said, "Smart girl," and proceeded to order them a Venetian feast that began with carpaccio and was followed by a risotto brimming with fresh green spears of asparagus. We finished with the leg of lamb, eggplant, and spinach, and, too sated for dessert, we ordered espresso and a glass of grappa. Mike's salad arrived, but he did not touch it when he found it was dressed with olive oil. So I instructed the waiter, in Italian, to bring us some ingredients from the kitchen. When they arrived, he mixed some yogurt and mayonnaise in a bowl, then added Worcestershire sauce and Tabasco, before he crumbled a wedge of gorgonzola into the mixture. The waiter tossed a fresh salad with a newly made dressing and could not hide his contempt for the result.
"Great stuff," Mike said happily as he tasted it. "I told you they had Roquefort cheese stashed around here somewhere."
It was only a few moments later that Mike brought up the subject he was in Venice to pursue.
"Let's talk a minute about the project. What do you two think? The greatest change in the South since World War II.
After thinking about it a moment, Ladere said,
"The invention of instant grits." "No, that's not it. That you can buy a taco, in almost any small town in the South."
Mike frowned and said, "You're not being serious. How about you, Jack?"
"I'm not going to work on your project, and I personally don't care what the biggest or the smallest change has been in the South."
"This is big money, Jack. More money than you've ever made. I've done some checking. Now, this is a personal favor from me to you. I had to do some fast talking to get you approved. Ladere's got a couple of credits, a little name recognition. Your Julia Child imitation doesn't bring shit to the project."
"I'm out of it, Mike."
"Will you work as a consultant?"
"No."
"Why?"
"Because you'll want us to write about Shiloh, and I'm not going to do that."
"We won't have to say she jumped off the bridge, or we can just do that off screen."
"Count me out. You're also going to want to write about Jordan in the 60s.
"No, wait a sec," Mike said, holding his hand in the air. "You're getting ahead of the game. See, I want it in a context, don't you see? It's not just about us, it's about this century. My grandfather coming to Waterford, not speaking but 10 words of English. He meets your grandfather, Jack. It changes both their lives forever. We're here at this table in Venice right now because of a pogrom that took place in Russia in 1921. Isn't that true?
Yes, I agreed. That's true.
Look, that past defined us, like it or not. And then we lived through some shit. You asked about Jordan. Hell yeah, we'll deal with Jordan. Who changed us more than Jordan Elliott? Do you know where he is, Jack?
A rumor has it he died. We all went to his memorial service.
Rumor has it that he's alive, that you know where he is. Rumor has it that he's in Italy.
If he is, he's never gotten in touch with me, I said.
If he had, would you tell me? Mike asked.
No, I wouldn't tell you.
I don't agree with what the son of a bitch did in the war, but goddamn, it's great drama, especially if we learn how he got away.
You could make up that part, couldn't you?
Ladere asked Mike.
Maybe Jack's right. Maybe he died while trying to escape or hide.
I want to get the truth, Mike said. It's a matter of principle that we be as factual as we can. I'm going to find that son of a bitch and pay him a ton of money to tell his story.
Did he say principle? Ladere asked me in mock surprise. Did Mike just say principle?
Another point of business, Mike said, ignoring Ladere. I want you both to hear me out on this before you start screaming. I know what you're going to say, but what I say might surprise you.
Fire away, Ladere said, shrugging her shoulders. I've joined Capers Middleton's campaign committee in his run for governor of South Carolina. I'm his executive chairman in charge of finance. We'd like very much to put both your names on his election committee.
Ladere looked perfectly stunned and said, How do you say fuck you in Italian, Jack?
You don't need to know. Just say fuck you in English and double it for me.
I know where both of you're coming from, but you're both wrong. The cat's changed. I talked with him in New York before I flew over here, and this is one forward-looking son of a bitch. He's got some real radical ideas about how to finance education and industry clear into the next century.
Yoo-hoo, Mike, Ladere purred murderously.
You forget I was married to the forward-looking son of a bitch. He had some real radical ideas about how to pay child support, too. He preferred not to.
His divorce from you is causing a little trouble in his campaign. I won't lie to you, Mike said.
Good, she said. He's a cold-hearted, ruthless bastard, Mike. I fell in love with him once, married him, had two children by him, and learned to hate him slowly and over time. He's poison in all the right places and all the wrong ones, too.
Now, he feels bad about you, Ladere. He told me that himself. He admits he was an asshole.
The University of South Carolina, I interrupted. 1970, Mike. Very big year. You may remember we learned something very significant about our boy, Capers Middleton, that year.
Not all of us, Ladere said.
Some of us didn't learn a thing about Capers' nature or sense of integrity from that telling moment. One of us went from that amazing existential moment and married him.
Mike breathed deeply and waited for our anger to pass before he resumed speaking.
No one hated Capers for that more than I did, but he stands by what he did and still thinks of it as an act of patriotism. He wants to tell us everything that led up to that night at the draft board. That'll be part of the miniseries.
I'm sorry, Mike. I'm off the project, Ladere said.
For God's sake, what's the big deal? Mike said. Besides, I know you both could use the cash.
Is that it, Mike? I asked. Do you think you can buy us, that we're for sale for the right price?
I'm not talking about buying anyone, Jack, Mike said, and now his tone changed.
I'm talking about doing good work and telling a great story and getting to know each other again. The money's just gravy, you know, all the chocolate ice cream you can eat.
And your friend Capers wants to tell us all about his heroic role at the university, come clean as an American hero?
He was a hero to a great many people. I'd say 95% of the people of South Carolina supported what he did.
Those same people all supported the Vietnam War.
The 60s. That's tired old shit, Jack. Lousy box office, Mike said,
still uncomfortable as the object of Ladere's uncompromising gaze. I want to go on record with you, Mike, right now. Say it up front. Everything I believed in the 60s, I still believe with all my heart. I've repudiated nothing, I said.
A lot of it was self-righteous bullshit. Admit it, Mike said.
I admit it, and I still believe it.
Okay, Mike said. What Capers did is open for debate. I've got an open mind on the subject, but it didn't hurt anyone. You got arrested, Jack, but you didn't do hard time.
No, it hurt all of us. It was a killing blow, Mike, see? We loved Capers and believed in him and followed him.
I smiled.
But you've gotten over it. Everyone has.
Not the guy you're looking for. I bet Jordan hasn't gotten over it, Ladea said. If he proves to be alive, I mean.
You do know where he is? Mike asked me again.
No, Mike. We went to his memorial service, remember? Because of Capers Middleton, none of us have seen Jordan since 1970.
Mike removed a checkbook from his breast pocket and wrote out a check for $10,000. He handed it to me.
That's a down payment. Take me to Jordan, and there's another $10,000 where that came from.
I looked at the check and laughed. I lit the end of it with a candle on the table that had burned nearly to the end of its taper. I watched as the check made a splendid blaze, and then I dropped it into Mike's espresso cup.
Mike, I want you to study me. Bone up for final exams. You need to learn how to be a human being again. You were a good one once. You just forgot the steps.
Mike leaned forward and his eyes blazed at me with rancor.
I got news for you, Jack. You ain't the captain of all the teams anymore. High school's over, and let's face it, little Mike's doing better than anybody. From People magazine to Who's Who to Oscar night, Michael Hess is someone to be reckoned with in the world of film. All of us at this table have done damn well. Ladea writes her celebrated screenplays. You write cookbooks for fat tourists and a couple of travel books to tell assholes how to get to the Sistine Chapel. But I win the sweepstakes.
Please shut up, Mike, Ladea said. Listen to yourself. Bragging about being in People magazine, for God's sake. It's too pathetic.
I'll say what I want to say. Look at Jack. So self-righteous and smug.
For what, Jack? For what goddamn reason? You burn the check up like you're Francis of fucking Assisi. But here's what I've learned, pal. I make that check large enough. I keep adding the figures. And eventually, I'll hit the price when you go to your knees and give me a blowjob.
You're going to be writing a long time before you hit that number, Mike, I replied, smiling in an attempt to diffuse the tension at the table.
But Mike seemed hell-bent to continue the frontal assault.
You sneer at me, you sneer at Capers Middleton, whose only sin is trying to make South Carolina a better place to live. We may not live up to your high fucking standards, Jack, but none of our wives ever went up on the bridge. All of our girls are still walking around with their Gucci bags and credit cards. None of them had to be fished out of the river. Sorry to be so blunt, old pal, but those are the facts.
I closed my eyes and did not open them until I felt under control. I wanted to lunge across the table at Mike and beat his face in until my fist ran with his blood. Then I thought about Leah and Shyla and did not respond to Mike's attack.
"Go ahead, Jack," Ladea said calmly. "Kill him. He deserves it."
"I'm sorry," Mike said suddenly. "Jesus, I'm sorry, Jack. That wasn't me that said that. Open your eyes. You can see remorse written all over me. R-E-M-O-R-S-E, remorse, as pure as it comes. I swear to you, Jack, that wasn't me talking. No one loved Shyla more than I did. You gotta give me that."
I opened my eyes and said, "I'll give you that. You loved Shyla, and that's the only reason I'm not drowning your sorry ass in the Grand Canal."
"Let me drown his ass," said Ladere. "Boys get to have all the fun."
"Great line," Mike said. "Write it down and I'll get it typed up in the morning. That'll go in the screenplay."
The evening ended. As we walked back to the greedy palace, Mike tried to undo the damage and was perfectly charming and even made me laugh a little. I said nothing and contented myself with listening to Mike. I knew him well enough to understand that jokes and laughter were part of his elaborate ritual of apology. But beneath my laughter, my mind was spinning. I had to return to Rome to warn Jordan Elliott that Mike Hess was hot on his trail.
Chapter 5. I drove Martha to the Rome airport, and once there, she checked and rechecked her tickets to South Carolina as soldiers from the Italian army walked by her carrying machine guns.
"I'll never get used to all these machine guns in airports," she said.
"It cuts down on shoplifting," I said.
"Let me buy you a cappuccino here. They won't let me go to the gate with you."
"Because of terrorism?"
"I guess. The Red Brigade's about petered out, but the PLO's still frisky. Libya's making noise. The IRA's around. Even a liberation movement in Corsica."
"Why do you live here with all this going on?"
"Wasn't Atlanta the murder capital of the U.S. last year?"
Yes, but the airport's perfectly safe, she said.
We bought cappuccinos and watched a group of brilliantly clad Saudis enter the building and pass a large contingent from Ghana, swathed in their native finery. It seemed a citizen from every country would pass you by if you only stood in the Rome airport long enough, and this connection to the whole world never failed to thrill me. I could smell the love of travel here and feel that rush of adrenaline in travelers as they glanced up at departure boards and studied the small numbers on their neatly inscribed tickets. An airport was a place where I could actually see time move. People sifted through doors and gates like sand through an hourglass.
I don't have to tell you this, Jack. Leah's a magnificent child. You're doing a splendid job.
Oh, I'm just watching, Martha. She's raising herself.
I wish you'd bring her back home.
I don't think so, I said, as softly as I could. I'm sorry, Martha.
I can promise there'll be no scenes.
How can you promise that? Not with your father.
Did you always hate him? She asked gently. Even when you were a child, our houses backed up to each other.
No, I only got to hate him after I really got to know the guy. I think it started when he sat shiver when Shiloh married me.
My mother begged him not to.
And so, when he sat shiver for a second time after Shiloh's death, my high regard for him only increased.
He's a good Jew. He was right to sit shiver then.
And he was dead fucking wrong to do it after she married me, I exploded.
Again, he thought he was being a good Jew.
And a bad human being. Do you like your father, Martha? Shiloh sure didn't. Martha was thoughtful for a moment.
I respect him, Jack. Pity him for all he's been through.
Whatever he went through, he sure as hell paid the world back in spades.
He says that you're keeping him away from his granddaughter's the cruelest thing he's faced, Martha said.
Good. Jack McCall surges past World War II in a nose-to-nose race to see who can make George Fox suffer most.
He can't help who he is or what makes him suffer, Martha said.
Neither can I, Martha. Now it's time to get you through security. At the security gate, we embraced and held each other for a long moment. I appreciate your doing this, Martha. It was a grand gesture. You took a chance, and I appreciate it.
I hope it's only the start. We'd like Leah to be part of our life, Jack. My mother wants to see you badly.
Tell her thanks. I'll think about it.
You and Shiloh, Jack, Martha said wonderingly. I never knew what made it work.
Neither did anyone else, I said, as Martha turned toward the opaque gazes of five heavily armed airport guards. I returned to my apartment and spent the rest of the day working on the article about Venice and the Greedy Palace. I like writing about strange cities and cuisines because it keeps me at arm's length from the subjects that are too close to me. To capture the sense of place in each country I visit, I work hard at turning homesickness into a kind of scripture as I describe what the native-born cherish most about their own countries. Writing about Venice always presents a challenge. The city is a peacock tail unfurled in the Adriatic, and the sheer infinity of its water-dazzled charms makes you long for a new, secret language, brimming with untried words that can only be used when describing Venice to strangers. Venice has always brought me face to face with the insufficiency of language when confronted by such timeless beauty. I've put in the hours trying to make that over-visited city mine and mine alone. I've tried to notice things that would surprise even Venetians. When I finished, I typed out four recipes I had received from different Venetian chefs, then addressed the article to the editor of the Sophisticated Traveler at the New York Times. Having given the package to the portiere, I walked across the Tiber to the shul Leah attended once a week. Leah came out surrounded by other children, the boys all wearing delicate little yarmulkes, small as mittens. She ran toward me when she saw me, and I picked her up and spun us both around in the street.
"Did Aunt Martha catch your plane?" Leah asked. "I just love her, Daddy. We had so much to talk about."
"Well, she worships you, sweetheart, but so does everyone else."
"She asked me a question I couldn't answer," she said, as we began to walk.
"Well, what was it?"
"Am I Jewish, Daddy?"
Leah asked.
"Martha asked me that, and the rabbi asks it all the time. The rabbi doesn't like it that I go to a Catholic school."
"Sua Rosaria doesn't like it that you go to shul, but according to Jewish law, you're Jewish."
"But you?"
she asked. "According to you, what am I?"
"I don't know, Leah," I admitted, as we walked through the noisy streets of Trastevere toward the river. "Religion's strange to me. I grew up Catholic, yet the church hurt me. It damaged me and made me afraid of the world. But it also filled me with wonder. Your mother was a Jew and proud of it.
She'd want you raised as a Jew, so that's why I sent you to Shul."
"What do you want me to be?"
"What I want is not important. You can choose for yourself. What I'd like is for you to study both and reject both."
"Do they worship different gods?" she asked.
"No, honey, I think it's the same cat. Look, I know I'm going to pay for this in the future. You'll grow up without religious roots, and when you're 18, I'll find you dressed in saffron Hare Krishna robes with your head shaved, chanting Hindi and playing a tambourine in the Atlanta airport."
"I just want to know if I'm a Jew or a Catholic."
"You pick, darling." And I squeezed her hand.
"Martha says that I'm a Jew."
"If that's what you want to be, then that's what you are. I'd love for you to be Jewish. Nothing would irritate my family more."
"What's South Carolina like?" Leah asked, changing the subject.
"Horrible. Very ugly and depressing to look at. It smells bad all the time, and the ground's covered with rattlesnakes. It has laws making all children slaves from the time they're born until they're 18. The state doesn't allow ice cream or candy to be sold inside the state line, and requires all kids to eat 5 pounds of Brussels sprouts a day."
"I hate Brussels sprouts."
"That's only the start. All kittens and puppy dogs are drowned as soon as they're born. Stuff like that. You never want to go there, trust me."
"Aunt Martha said it was beautiful, and that she wanted me to come visit her next summer. May I go?"
We walked on without my responding. "What kind of ice cream do you want?" I asked, as we walked into the bar near the Piazza Trilussa.
"Limone o fragola?"
"Fragola," she said, but that didn't answer my question. "You want to eat 5 pounds of Brussels sprouts a day and be sold into slavery?"
"You just say those things so I won't ask about Mama."
We ate our cones in silence. Mine was hazelnut, which reminds me of smoke and ice and darkness. Leah had chosen the strawberry ice cream today. Each day she alternated between the taste of lemons and strawberries. It was one way she brought a sense of order and structure to her motherless life. On the Ponte Sisto, we stopped and looked down at the Tiber, its flow quickening as it neared the rapids close to the Isola Tiberina. Two elderly fishermen were casting their lines into the river, but I knew I lacked the raw physical courage required to eat a fish caught in those impure waters. Even in the softest light, the Tiber looked roomy and colicky.
"I know all about Mama," Leah said, licking her cone.
"If Martha said one word..."
"She didn't," Leah jumped in quickly. "I've known for a long time now."
"How'd you find out?" I said, careful not to look at her, keeping my eyes on the fisherman.
"I heard Maria talking to the portiere," she said. "They didn't know I was listening."
"What did they say?"
"That Mama killed herself by jumping off a bridge,"
Leah said, and as the words came out of my pretty, over-serious daughter, I could feel the ruthless slipping of my heart. She tried to say it matter-of-factly, but the words resonated with the awful authority of Shiloh's act. At that very moment, I knew that by treating her as an equal, I had robbed her of any chance of being a child. Worse, I had allowed Leah to mother me, stealing from a generous, eager child what my own mother had rarely been known to offer me. I had let Leah carry my implacable sorrow and turned her childhood into a duty.
"Maria said my mother was burning in hell. That's what happens to people who kill themselves."
"No," I said, kneeling beside her and gathering her to me. I tried to see if she was crying, but could see nothing through my own tears.
"Your mother was the sweetest, finest woman I've ever met, Leah. No God would ever hurt a woman that decent and good. No God would say a word to a woman who suffered so much. If a God like that exists, I spit on that God. Do you understand?"
"No," she said.
"Your mother had periods of great sadness," I whispered. "She would feel them coming and warn me that she was going away for a while, but she'd be back. There were doctors, hospitals. They gave her pills, did everything they could, and she'd always come back, except the last time."
"She must have been very sad, Daddy," Leah said, crying openly now.
"She was.
Couldn't you help her?
I tried to help her, Leah. You can be sure of that.
Was it me? Was she unhappy when I was born?
Leah asked. I knelt and held her close again, letting her cry long and hard, and waited for her to slow down before I spoke. There never was a baby loved like your mother loved you. Her eyes filled up with love whenever she looked at you. She couldn't keep her hands off you, wanted to breastfeed you forever. Shyla loved every single thing about you.
Then why, Daddy, why?
I don't know, darling, but I'll try to tell you everything I understand. I promise if you'll remove the strawberry ice cream cone from the back of my neck. We both laughed and dried each other's tears with the napkins that had come with the cones. I knelt down on one knee and let Leah wipe the ice cream from my shirt and neck. Two diminutive nuns approached us on the bridge, and when I made eye contact with one of them, she looked to the ground, shy as a whelk.
"Do you think it hurt?" Leah asked. "When she hit the water?"
I don't think she was feeling much. She'd taken a bunch of pills before.